All right, welcome back, and thanks for staying with us or joining us. Our next talk will be from Goswin Rothenthal. So welcome, Goswin. Hello, how are you?
Hello, hello, Thomas. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Great.
So you're going to talk. I think you're one of the really interesting people here because your background is definitely not a software development.
No, it's not.
So what do you do?
Well, that is actually already my first slide. I'm an architect.
All right. So we're going to learn more about that when you start. One last question. Where are you actually now, right now at the moment?
Right now, I'm in Vienna in my office, and it's 8 o'clock, so it's nice and empty by now.
Okay, so it's 8 o'clock in the evening in Vienna, and we're ready for our next talk from Goswin. So I think we're ready. If you can start the screen sharing, then we can get started, and people can learn more about you and your work, which I think is pretty amazing.
Okay, let me get my screen shared.
Very well. So now we can still see you, and hopefully we'll get the screen there in a second. I think in Skype is that little plus button.
Do you have the screen?
Now we're almost there. Yep, and there it is. Yep. We can see your screen. I'm gonna put it on full screen here.
Great.
And there we go.
So yep. You see my screen?
We can see your screen. Everything good?
Right.
You're ready to go.
Great. So as Thomas mentioned before, my background is architecture and not computer science or software. But I worked for 6 years in London at Zaha Hadid Architects. And the geometries we were working with were very complicated, and we had to build them. And also this project in Macau, and we needed to use software in order to manage our geometries. So for parametric models like this, the most common tool is RhinoScript, which is based on VBScript, and it's hosted inside the Rhino 3D modeling tool. So you will see that in the end. My talk shows you first the Luva Abu Dhabi project for about 15 minutes, and then I will swap to actually a little demonstration. So now I'm working at Wagner Biro. Wagner Biro is a specialist contractor for complicated steel and glass structures. We have done building like the Reichstag in Berlin, or the tip of the Swiss Re building in London, or the courtyard of the British Museum. The project I'm talking about today is the Louvre Abu Dhabi. It is a project designed by Jean Nouvel, an architect from Paris. Like with many projects, there's usually a lot of companies involved. So our main client was TDIC. The project manager was managing company was Turner. The architect, as I said, Jean Nouvel. The design engineer and the supervising engineer was Bureau Hapold from London and Bath. The main contractor was a joint venture from Arabtec, San Jose, and Auger. And Wagner Biro was the subcontractor for the steel and aluminium cladding parts. So this is how the development of Sadiat Island is intended to look when it's done. Here you see the current screenshot from Google Earth. I'm pointing to the Louvre Abu Dhabi here. This state is already a few months old. This shows the concept from Jean Nouvel. He wanted to have several museum pavilions below a gigantic dome that is shading those museum pavilions. So you can see here below the museum pavilions, and on top of that, a dome. The dome is not watertight, it just provides shadow, and it draws a pattern through these shading layers. There are 4 layers on the outer side and 4 layers on the inner side. In between is a steel framework. The steel framework itself is already very complicated, and it's only held up on 4 corners. but I'm going to be talking only about the cladding layers today. Here you see this pattern as it was imagined by Jean Nouvel, and the play of sunlight coming through, drawing a pattern on the floor. He calls it the rain of light. But let's go to the engineering. The geometry of the dome is actually relatively simple. It's based on a sphere with regular planes cutting through it. So there are these planes cutting through the segment of a sphere, and these cutting patterns run in both X and Y directions. The result is an underlying grid that you can see here. So this underlying grid is nice and square in the center, but it's actually distorted towards the edge. That means, since we are orienting our pattern along, can you hear me? Good. I have some background noise, a bit strange. Okay, good.
You can ignore the background noise.
So this this pattern is not regular, and that's why we have all the elements of our cladding are gradually transforming, and none of them are identical, even though they look very similar. So here you see four of the four cladding layers. These four cladding layers have a different scaling, they have a different density, and they have a different rotation to create this intrinsic pattern that you have seen before. The different density was derived in various lightning studies that were done by Jean Nouvel, Biro Happold, and Transolar. The concept was to provide the museum's buildings with as maximum amount of daylight onto the glass roof, while the water and the public plaza area should be in the shadow. So they made some intensive lightning studies, and the result was a bitmap that defines the density of the light from 8 to 0%, ideally. This is what we then translated into our geometry, where we defined these star elements, as we call them, with various sizes. Also here, you can see how the density of the dome in the center is less than on the edges. So this slide actually shows very well the principle of the unit that we used for installation. We called it a star. One star can be composed out of several aluminium profiles that are clipped together, and they have various sizes depending on the shading requirement, whether it's small, we use the slim star, or whether we have want to have it rather dark below, then we use the white star. And in the transition zones, the star have a mixed combination of profiles. You can see here a sketch of how these aluminium profiles are clipped together. In total, one star is made up to 120 individual cut profiles that are clipped together. You can see here how they are arranged and numbered. And we obviously needed to cut them at the ends and cut them to the right size. So this here is already jumping very quickly deep into details. You can see a system drawing of how these profiles are cut at the end. They have different angles, they have different drilling holes for the corner connectors, and they have some interior slots to accommodate some end plate structures. But so in order to define all of these profiles, and in total we have almost 500,000 of aluminium profiles that needed to be cut, we didn't make a drawing for every profile. We just defined variables like the total net lengths, the amount of drilled holes, the slots, and the angle. And then from these angles, our manufacturer directly controlled the CNC cutting machines. So this was the derived data for each line represents one profile with all the values that need to be taken in consideration for the CNC milling. In total, this was 460,000 lines of individual elements. This is now how one of these aluminium profiles looks when they come out of the extrusions. And this is one of the machines that was used to cut the profiles and mill the holes in the end. Here you can see one of the initial profiles being cross-checked with the list if everything was done correctly. Then there was a relatively detailed assembly instructions for how to this clear sequence of how these elements with the corner connectors have to be put together. Here you can see again the individual elements that make up one star, and here how they are clipped together. Here again an example of the profiles clipped together. This end profile will be covered with an end plate. This is another image from the workshop where you can see the profiles. There was obviously a lot of logistics involved in storing the profiles before they could all be assembled after being cut, and a lot of manual work in assembling those profiles to stars. For every star, we had a drawing to not only check the dimensions, but to also see where we have to install the connectors that you see marked here with little circles. These connectors are connecting the stars to each other and are holding the structure together. You can see there in total 7,850 stars. So we have a drawing for the top and a drawing for the bottom side. So in total, we have 17,500 drawings. These drawings were actually printed and used on site. These drawings, as you see them, were all generated in the software, in the CAD software Rhino, and our script that was driving it was written in F#. That also includes the QR code that you see here that we used later for tracking them. Now I show you part of my 3D model. What you see here in the 3D model is more of a visualization than the actual information that we used for fabrication, but it helped to understand the system. So what you see is the underlying steel structure of the steel space frame, the top chart. And there we have to install the posts. These posts are derived from intersecting the positions of the cladding with the axis of the underlying steel. On top of this first layer of cladding is another series of connectors that are holding the next layer. On top of that layer, another series of connectors. And all of this position of these connectors was predefined on the drawings that you have seen before. So these drawings already defined where these connectors are sitting, and we could deliver the stars with all the connectors pre-installed. So another layer of connectors, and another layer, and this is the last layer of cladding on top of that. Here you see some details at the end of one of these profiles, or here as well. This image shows our naming concept, so together with the parametric model, which was based on a half-edge data structure, we also included a naming that followed that principle. This is a partial model where you can see the underlying steel structure and several layers of cladding incrementally added. Now we're already on site. This is the steel structure going up here as well. This is one of the first cladding stars installed. These cladding elements have still a protective plastic foil on them that will be removed in the end. This is more into the project of the cladding elements. Here the dome is almost done. Some views from the interior where the cladding elements have already been cleaned. Also here. This is some support towers that are currently being dismantled. You see in the background how the light is shining through those cladding stars. By now, the dome is actually completed, and we're only doing some quality checking. This is on the inside again. This is one star element before it gets lifted up. And the completed dome here. You can find more images on this website from thenational.ae. As you have seen, many images of most of the recent ones I've been taking from there. So, how about F sharp? I used F sharp in Visual Studio for the main logic and the main data structure, for the core and for the comprehensive, for generating the lists. And I used Rhino for hosting the F-sharp and to actually draw geometry and to save drawings and to turn around my 3D model. And Tsunami is a nice F-sharp editor that can be hosted inside Rhino to generate to draw elements, because it's not possible to draw in Rhino directly from Visual Studio. It needs to be hosted inside Rhino. So now I want to explain you the data structure of the cladding elements. I have drawn here them on a grid. And what you see here is really the core elements that define the grid and that are what I used to define this grid. And I'm not only taking the star element itself, I'm also describing I think you see my mouse pointer. I'm also using the octagon here as an element in my data structure in order to be able to do offsets here inside this octagon and inside the triangle and inside this quadrilateral face here. So what I did is I describe these, I consider each of these, this octagon, the four triangles and the square in the center as faces that I have continuous points around it. So that's what I described down here. You can see in the beginning the octagon, four triangles, and in the end you can see the last face, the square in the center. And I described them here just by X and Y coordinate. And what you see here actually is already F-sharp code as I have written it here. It doesn't need to be much more complicated. And you will see now how I'm taking this this little description of the pattern into Rhino, and I will actually be generating this single element. Okay, so let's see it live. Are you still hearing me, Thomas?
I hear you, and now we can see your 3D model starting.
Okay.
With Tsunami on the side.
Exactly. So this here is my I can shut down. This is my is the Rhino 3D modeling environment. Anyone who wants to test this can download it, a 90-day trial for free. It's fully functional. So they're very Rhino is very generous in for testing, and student licenses are actually very cheap also. And Tsunami installation by default comes with a Rhino plugin. So you just need to drag and drop that plugin once into Rhino, and then you can load Tsunami by just typing Tsunami here in the command line. like this. Okay, so let's go to our grid. So this pattern that I've shown you and the definition of one element, you can see it here, now here in defined as an array of arrays in F sharp. So let me reset this here first. So first I just load this by just pressing Alt and Enter. And now I have my array of arrays defined. There, here I have a tuple of integers. So in order to work with this array, I create a little function that maps onto nest arrays of arrays. So I will use this little map, this inverse pipe operator to create that function. You can see now this function is defined as arrays of array of A to arrays of array of B. So now I have the mapping function that I will be using always to iterate over this pattern here. Next, I'm referencing the Rhino DLL and opening the Rhino geometry namespace. So far you don't see anything. And I will convert now these tuples of integers into actually 3D points. So this 3D point is defined in Rhino geometry, in the namespace I just opened. I convert the U and V value to float, and the set value will be just zero. Now, as you can see here, I have now this array of points. You still don't see them. And I could now actually draw these points, but I would be more interested in drawing the lines. So I'm creating I'm creating an array of lines where I'm always using then this element and the element afterwards. So I'm first taking the index, and then I'm iterating through this array here, taking always the element and the next one to create a line instance. A line is just defined as 2 points. And last, I create connect the last with the first element here in this pattern. So now I have created all these line instances. You still don't see them. And now I'm actually going to draw them. So I'm going to reference the current document of Rhino. And then I'm using the map function that I defined before to add these lines. And then in the end, I'm going to redraw my view. So this is now drawing these pattern here. You think that's a lot of effort? It could maybe be done simpler, but the way I build it up, I can work from here on, and I still have all these points in the sequence, and I will be laterally able to add them to a data structure that represents each of the faces as a circular element. So in order to now extend the grid, I'm going to define a little function that shifts these lines around. So this is here my shift line function. It takes a tuple of the x and y offset and a line, and it constructs a new line where it adds the offsets. And how often do I want to do this? Let's just do it once. It's always 6 steps, because 6 steps is the unit from here to here. The distance from here to here is 6 units. So that's why I need to always shift it by a minimum 6. So I shift it from -6 to +6. This is my new grid. Then I'm going to map this grid onto the lines. And in the end, I draw it. Oopsala. Something went wrong here. Shouldn't have the Y. Obviously, I have to add the Y offset to the Y coordinate. Let me delete this. So I run this whole block again. And now you see how the grid gets generated. I'm gonna make this grid a little bit bigger by putting a higher value here. Let's do 8 units in both directions, and I redraw this. Now you see how this grid is generated. And when you click on these elements here, you will notice that they're actually always 2 because they're pointing in opposite direction. One line points in this direction, while the other line points in the other direction. One of these lines belongs to this octagon, and the other line belongs to the triangle here. That's why I wanted to have them double, because I work with half edges later. Now we want to map this pattern onto the sphere. Let's just delete this again here. So I define a function that takes a 3D point and maps that point onto the sphere. So we need a we define the angle, how much we want to move one unit on the sphere, and that becomes so we take the UV coordinate and it becomes the angle. Then we have this sinus cosinus function for the mapping, and in the end we divide the radius of the sphere with the square root of the x and y value in order to get the set coordinate, which we use here in the end to construct our point 3D. So now we have defined the function to map onto the sphere. We now need to map the line also onto the sphere, because I have created lines so far. So I also reconstruct the lines from these 2 points. It takes a line and it takes the 2 points of the lines and maps them and returns a new line. And I'm now going to run this with the shifted edges that I created up here. And now you see how this pattern wraps around the sphere. If you want, you can extend it. We can basically make here more. Let's go to 12. Expand the grid. And then you see how this slowly comes around. Let's give it even more, maybe 16. I'm still not there at half the sphere. Yeah, now you see we have the half sphere completed at the bottom here. It doesn't work anymore because it doesn't work for negative values because of this square function here that takes out the negative values. So we only get positive coordinates. Okay, so far for this, let me delete this again here. I want to show you now how the angle affects the size. Let's not draw the flat ones. I disable this line here to not draw the flat part. So I have now drawn again this part of the sphere, and now I'm going to change the angle of one element. I'm going to half this to get a smaller grid. I'm going to run the same again. Something went wrong because obviously I made it too big. Should be 0.7 and 0.07. So now you see a very small grid here. Let's make the grid bigger again. And now you can see how the new grid is exactly half the size of the previous grid, and these 2 patterns are overlaying here. Okay, so this is in brief how the pattern is constructed of an individual layer. I could also change the radius here and have a smaller radius for the same thing. For example, now I would have the same pattern with a smaller radius down here. Next, I want to show you the real code, which is obviously a bit more complicated. So let's open a new file. New empty file, and so I'm here referencing the DLL of Tsunami itself, the Rhino Common DLL, and the two DLLs that I wrote for this project. I'm loading the Rhino script syntax as well. In order for Tsunami to operate smoothly with Rhino, we need to switch the host context while executing commands. So there's this little function that switches the context to the host context while running in Tsunami. So I use this do async function to run it asynchronously. So let's build the first layer, or maybe we start with an inner one. Let's start with the layer number 5. So now I have defined the data structure. Here we have 3,900 edges, 1,995 nodes, and 937 faces. So this is now the data structure is constructed. Now I actually want to draw them. So let's draw the most simplest version of them. Let's draw them as axes. Where are they? Here they are. I needed to zoom out because with the drawing is in millimeters, so it's 180,000 millimeters. So this is now the layer 5, one of the inner layers, just drawn by the axis. In the next step, I might show you the wings. So now you see the wings of these individual profiles, and you can already recognize that in the center, they're slimmer and they're getting wider towards the edge here. We can also draw the individual profiles. Here they are. No. Here they are. So now you see the actual profiles that compose a panel. One here, a small panel, a profile here, then a connecting profile here. And this is actually all the information that we needed for going to manufacturing, because with this little four-sided polygon, a profile is exactly defined by length and by edge. And all the other, not with the cutting patterns here, so we're not quite exact, but this is all we needed in order to have the basic geometry defined. I have then another script on top that actually shows the profile in 3D. So we can also visualize them in 3D. Oh, it's still drawing here. I need to shade my view. Now you can see here. You can see the profiles modeled actually as 3D elements with the channel here that connects the two profiles together. I could now go and make another layer, let's say layer 1 on the outside. Define layer 1. draw this one as polylines. Now I will have the outer layer here as well. Now I have one of the inner and one of the outer layers. And another option that we used in order to really check what's going on in these profiles is to actually generate the full detail of one of these profiles. So I have a function here that if I do it for all profiles, my graphic card will not manage to do this anymore. So I'm now gonna select some profiles, and from the object name, I'm gonna generate the underlying profile, the underlying real detailed profile. So now you see I'm switching now to the random context, and here you can see the string that was my prompt string here. Let's select this one, maybe also this one. And I have obviously saved in the background the section of these profiles, and now these profiles are put onto this element here. So now you really see in detail, including the drilling holes that we have here, how one of these elements look. You also see the drilling hole here for this pin. So this is not another slotted hole for the end plate, which needs to connect through here. The channels for the screws here. This is not actually what was used for manufacturing, but that is what we used for controlling the geometry and being sure that everything works out, that we don't have collisions here in this kink or in this kink. And yeah. If you want to see the full model, I can draw that one as well. So now I'm generating the full model. This is now the full model of all 8 layers. So Rhino has been really useful as a very easy platform that's very accessible for simple drawing exercises, and maybe next I try to set up the same drawing routines in Fun 3D. Maybe if Sean helps me, maybe we can make this work for the next presentation. That would also be a possibility. But the code itself runs without Rhino, but I need obviously a 3D engine in order to visualize it, to check it, and also to debug. So my debugging environment was actually a 3D environment and not a classical debugger. And the code is actually doesn't use any external libraries except for F# Core. So it was a bit of an exercise to really understand the needs and understand the geometry behind it. Rhino is normally built for NURBS, that means free-form geometries. In that case, the geometry was only consistent of lines and polygons, so it was geometrically, it was all in the Euclidean space, and it was not beyond that.
All right. That was pretty amazing. So there was a lot of people on Twitter saying, wow, that's amazing. So I think we should really stream the next year's F-sharp conf from the dome itself. That would be the best way to do it.
Yeah, I will try to arrange that.
Cool. So I think one interesting theme here was that
I don't see the question streams or the Twitter stream. Is there anything that came up?
I'm going to ask all the questions, so no worries. So I guess one interesting sort of point was your background is not a developer. So what was it like for you to get into F-sharp and start writing code in it?
The answer is very simple. I started with VBScript, then I followed with Python, Iron Python, so the .NET implementation of it, which was also used, I always used it for generating 3D models. And then I looked for something that is a bit more actually performant. So my first concern was performance. So I realized I need to go to a typed language for performance. And while I then compared VB and C sharp and F sharp, I realized that F sharp, it looks like Python. Let's try that one. And then I slowly discovered all the beautiful advantages of functional programming. I read a lot of the writings from John Harrop and also from Scott Blashing. Those were my two biggest teachers. And then I pretty fast picked it up, and the beauty and the expressiveness, I fell in love with it very fast. For example, defining your data structure like this, where it really where you really see what you do, or defining mapping functions like this in one line, that was really what convinced me to stick with that language, where I can really have that scripting feeling that I was looking for, at the same time having great performance and type safety on top.
Yeah, no, I think sort of many people, even if when they do like software development, they actually appreciate the same sort of things. They don't use it as an embedded CAD tool, but they sort of prototype their algorithms, any sort of code interacting with libraries in pretty much the same way. So I guess the sort of really nice thing here was that you could just live code things and see it happen immediately.
Yeah.
The really cool thing though you had there was the Tsunami editor. So what was your experience with that? How did you get it to work with Rhino?
Well, actually, Matt Maloney, the creator of Tsunami, I met him in London at a meetup, and I asked around if there is something editor that I could host inside Rhino, because at the moment Rhino only has a Python editor. And then I met Matt, and he said, "Yeah, of course I have an editor. You can host it in Rhino." And we met again, and within 2 hours, he gave me a Rhino plugin that was hosting his editor.
So that's a really good story of what can happen if you come to the F-Sharp meetups. All right. Well, thank you very much again for joining us. That was really, really amazing talk. We'll be back in a few seconds with the next talk from Mark Seaman. So thanks again.
Thank you, Thomas.